Maybe we wandered away from our elders over time. It used to be that we sought out the advice of older and wiser people to help guide us through the intricacies of daily living. Today's guest works to return us to the wisdom of the ages, and we're talking a lot of ages and a lot of wisdom. Roman Krznarek's latest book is called How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. If the name sounds familiar, Roman Krznarek was our guest just a few months ago to talk about another book. He's one of those rare people who can crank out two books inside of a year and end up here in the guest chair of the Jefferson Exchange. Roman Krznarek has been called a lifestyle philosopher. He taught sociology and politics at a couple of universities and is a founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. When we talked to him last June, it was about his book, How to Find Fulfilling Work. Roman Krznarek, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks very much for having me on the program.
It's always good to have you here. Can you remind us what the School of Life is all about?
Yeah, the School of Life is an alternative education institution, like an alternative college that was invented to be a place where you could go along and learn the stuff that you don't normally learn at school or college, like how to make love last, how to find fulfilling work, how to face the realities of death and the inevitabilities of that. And it started in London as a place where you could go and do classes and courses and things. And we've now spread to Brazil. We're opening in Turkey, in the United States, France, and many other places. So it's the kind of place that hopefully you can learn a bit of wisdom about life for everyday living.
And again, drawing on the experience of people from ages past.
We draw on history, on sociology, anthropology, psychology, film, everything, you name it. But my specialty in my new book, How Should We Live, is about drawing on history.
Well, I'm reminded, I noticed that the title is different on either side of the Atlantic. Why is it not called The Wonder Box in the United States?
Yeah, it's a curious thing that when it was released in Britain, it was called The Wonder Box. And the idea there was that history is a bit like a wonder box, which are these old curiosity cabinets from the Renaissance, where collectors would put together collections of, you know, artifacts from different cultures and periods in history. And each of those artifacts was like a wonderful you know, thing you could hold up and stare at in awe and learn from. The idea that was that history was a bit like that as well. But the realities of publishing is that my American publisher thought that we ought to have just a more straightforward title about what's really at the cornerstone of the book. And in fact, the opening lines of the book on both sides of the Atlantic is, "How should we live?"
Interesting. But so this way you'll end up in the self-help section in the American bookstores for sure.
Well, I think we all need some help, so I don't really mind where it is as long as people get inspired by the ideas.
This is a bit of a trend at the moment, isn't it? You're the second author we've had on the past few months to talk about using certainly philosophy from the ancients for applications in modern life.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a bit of a crisis in the art of living. You know, I think we're all struggling with questions about what to do with our lives. Partly that's because the way we fall in love and make friendships has changed because of online, you know, dating and things like that. It's partly because more and more people are, you know, unhappy with their jobs. 50% of people are getting divorced. We're living longer than ever before and having to think about, well, how should I spend those extra years that medical technology has given me? So I think there's a lot of people thinking about, well, you know, how do I face those big questions in life? And I think there is great wisdom in history and philosophy that we don't normally look at, because if you walk down the personal development and self-help corridors of your local bookstore, most of those books are based on ideas from psychology or sometimes religious and spiritual thought. And that seems a shame, because there's amazing wisdom in the past, interesting figures, great ideas that I think we should kind of steal and run with for today.
So, for example, when you walk down the aisles of those bookstores, and we're being a little metaphorical here, but do you think, well, I mean, so-and-so said this back in the 13th century, or this person said this back in the Renaissance? I mean, are you often struck by the comparisons between what's out there now offered as pop psychology or something, and the fact that there is an underpinning that it exists long before it came around?
Absolutely. I mean, you can walk down those metaphorical bookshelves and in the bookstores and see lots of books, for example, about love and how to make your love life better. But when I look at history, I think, well, look at the ancient Greeks. You know, 2,500 years ago, they were thinking about love, I think, in a more sophisticated and useful way than most of us are thinking about it today, including the people who write some of those psychology books. I mean, the ancient Greeks said that there were six different kinds of love. They had six different words for it, which is actually very different from how we tend to talk about love today. You know, you might sign an email, lots of love, and whisper on the same day, I love you, to your partner over a romantic meal. And the Greeks would have thought, wow, that's pretty crude, because they had one word for sexual passion, which was eros, another word for deep friendships, where you'd really sacrifice for a friend. That was called philia, the kind of opposite of a Facebook friendship, where you try and, you know, have lots of superficial friendships. They had another word for selfless love, and for a healthy kind of self-love, playful love, mature love. And I think, you know, today that's a useful cure to our idea where we try and find all these loves in one kind of person. And the Greeks thought, actually, tap into the many sources of love and maybe try and find these various loves with different people in your life, and that might actually make it better.
With all these different types of love, I noticed that the pragma is one of them, as in pragmatism?
Yeah, that's right. The one pragma is about the idea of the kind of love that develops between a long-married couple who have learned to compromise and show tolerance and, in a way, be pragmatic about making the relationship last through time. And, in fact, in the 50s, actually, there was an interesting 1950s, this is an interesting psychiatrist called Eric Fromm, who made this very good distinction between standing in love and falling in love. And he said, we spend too much time falling in love. That's all that head over heels, eros stuff. And actually, we need to learn more to stand in love. And that's about that ancient Greek idea of pragma, about making a relationship last. And as I said, if you get married today, there's a 50% chance you're going to get divorced. I think the ancient Greeks would have thought, inject a bit more pragma into the way you think about love.
Huh. Six different kinds of love, and much more to talk about with Roman Krznarek. His book is How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. You can join us via email when we return. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Roman Krznarek and your thoughts and ideas in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Roman Krznarek from the School of Life in London. This is the second time we've had him on in a year. He's managed to have different books each time. This latest one is called How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. This is sort of like turning around that expression, those who do not remember the past are doomed to repeat it. This is our chance to get out of that cycle by drawing on the wisdom of people who lived long ago to talk about how we should be living in today's world. Without a phone screener today, we can't take phone calls, but we can take your emails, and those are more than welcome at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Roman, there's a quote in here from Goethe that you include here about not drawing from the lessons of history. What is that?
Right. So one of my favorite writers is this 18th century dramatist Goethe, who said that he who cannot draw on 3,000 years is living from hand to mouth. And that idea was at the cornerstone of writing this book. I thought, okay, let's look at the last 3,000 years of history and see what we can find. And it's really quite a challenge. You think, well, where do you start doing that? And one of the places I thought I'd start is actually on my wrist, because I looked down and saw, if you look down at anybody, look down at your own wrist, you'll probably see a wristwatch there, and you'll see that clocks are everywhere in our lives. And you'll see them on your computer screen, on your cell phone, everywhere you go, in your microwave oven. And one of the first things I did with writing the book was to look at the history of time and to realize and learn that actually our obsession with time is a modern invention. In fact, we've been slicing up time into smaller and smaller pieces. You know, back when Leonardo da Vinci painted The Last Supper, he wasn't constantly looking at his watch or checking his electronic calendar, right? You know, and it wasn't, in fact, until 1700 that clocks had minute hands, and 1800 till they had second hands, and life started getting faster and faster and faster, until today you've got a situation where 1 in 4 Americans say that they are constantly rushed, and that figure goes up to 40% for single mothers.
You've got the book divided up into four major categories: nurturing relationships, making a living, discovering the world, and breaking conventions. And we've already talked a bit about love and the fact that there were six different terms among the Greeks. The discussion of time you were just talking about comes a bit later in the book. There's an interesting painting in here, though. There are illustrations in the book, and I really enjoyed getting into the section on time and seeing this Japanese painting of an American couple circa 1861 or so, and the representation of them. And can you walk us through what we're seeing there?
Yeah, there's this fantastic 19th century print of a Japanese print of an American man holding up a pocket watch. And And actually, the caption underneath the picture says that, you know, it talks about how Americans are quite patriotic and actually quite clever because they invented things like the pocket watch. Because it was actually in the around the 19th century that people started carrying timepieces on them. And then by the 1880s, they started strapping watches onto their wrists, a kind of voluntary handcuff. And it was an extraordinary shift. Suddenly we were carrying time around with us everywhere, and other cultures like the Japanese thought that this was pretty unusual, where they weren't so obsessed with the time. And I think you can debate whether it's a good or bad thing, the way we're so obsessed with time. Of course, I don't want to be late taking my kids to school. I want to make sure there's a clock around. But equally, I think time does get us a bit stressed out. And I think that, you know, for everyday solutions, I suggest putting yourself on a chronological diet, which is spending at least one weekend putting your watch away or taking the time off the front of your cell phone. And, you know, it could be a total disaster, but actually you might find it quite liberating.
Well, that's a question that really came to mind, though, as I read this section, though, which is, can we be flexible enough to live by constant deadlines? You know, I have to be here by this time, I have to be there by that time, I have to finish work by this time, I have to call this person, pick this kid up, blah, 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 blah. Can we live by all those deadlines and then find a way to relax?
It is really difficult because there are so many structures imposed on us, telling us we've got to be at certain places and certain times and all the deadlines that you mentioned. But I think we can start trying to rethink time in a deep way ourselves. If we realize that we haven't always been this obsessed with time, you start thinking, well, maybe I can approach it differently. I mean, I think we should be doing slow time activities. So in your leisure time, not just, you know, trying to fit in as many activities as you can. If you go to an art gallery, try visiting one or two paintings rather than rushing through the whole thing. And it starts shifting your attitude. Equally, I think we can talk about time even in new ways. I mean, think of that idea of leisure time. We tend to talk about that vacation time as time off. An implication there is that at work is time on. But imagine if you just flip that around and you start thinking of your leisure time not as time off, but actually time on. This is the time that really matters to me when I'm on, when I should be pursuing my passions or my interests or playing with my kids. Maybe we wouldn't stay quite so late at the office all the time. Maybe we would slow down a bit and, you know, spend more time in our relationship. So I think there are little things we can do, even though culture is pushing us to run faster and faster.
What is this concept that you bring up in the time section about the clock of the long now?
Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful project actually invented by a musician, Brian Eno, and the great futurologist from San Francisco, Stuart Brand. And their idea was to invent this slow time clock. And the idea of the clock is to make us rethink our relationship to time. Because when somebody says to you, what time is it now? Well, you say, well, it's, you know, it's 26 minutes past 6 or it's 4:30. You don't tend to say it's 2014 or it's the early 21st century. Our conception of now is very immediate. And their idea is, well, let's think about the now as a long period. Let's think about where we are immersed in the present is something that extends into the future, and that way we might be more responsible people, more responsible about looking after our planet and caring for future generations. So they invented this clock, which they're building right now in the Texas desert, actually, and it's a clock which is called the 10,000-year clock, and it's designed to strike only once every century. So it's a very slow time clock, and I think we have a little bit of that attitude. Again, we might well, you know, wean ourselves off our immediate time obsessions.
Interesting. It strikes once a century.
Yeah, why not? In fact, they made a prototype of the clock, and when the year 2000 struck, it donged or made a ding only twice, once for each 1,000 years rather than each century. That was really slow time.
Wow. Roman Krznarek's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. This is a conversation you can join, sadly, not via phone because we don't have a phone screener today. You can join us via email at jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back again to the front of the book. I mean, the four major categories, again, nurturing relationships, making a living, discovering the world, and breaking convention. So you do start with love, and you did talk about love first. I want to come back, though, to a very specific question about how you respond to people who might insist, for example, that ancestors could not foresee things like online dating.
Well, it's certainly true that you could look in the past and think that it isn't really relevant to today. You know, are those ancient Greek kinds of love any use when we're trying to, you know, as you say, you know, do a bit of online dating. But I think it's about the ideas which can inspire and also the figures from the past that can inspire us. I mean, if you think, for example, the idea of finding a soulmate, we all, you know, 94% of young Americans say they want to find a soulmate. That's their ambition. You know, one single person who will embody all of their loving needs. And that's what people are looking for online. But actually, if you look at the past and realize that the idea of a soulmate has only been around for about 150 years, and people used to spread love over many more kinds of relationships, like deep friendships and other kinds of things, love of strangers, then you might even start rethinking your attitude to, you know, the online relationship. Maybe it should be something different. Maybe your expectations are too high. Because often, I mean, what's the reality is that a lot of people who look for relationships online treat it a little bit like shopping. Falling in love has become a bit like shopping, where you try and find someone who meets your 10 perfect criteria, and you might meet that person, but then if they're no longer satisfy all those criteria, you might try and upgrade like you do with your cell phone to a better model. And that's one of the reasons I think we have so many short-term relationships. So I think there's always a bit of wisdom to find in the past, even if the present does look rather different.
Well, you do take a bit of a riff on St. Valentine here. And so tell us why he would be surprised at today's view of him.
Yeah, St. Valentine, you know, we all think of him as the patron saint of lovers. But in fact, go back 1,000 years, and the original St. Valentine was a patron saint of epileptics. He was a saint of charitable or selfless love, which is really amazing. That shift happened in the 14th century. And then St. Valentine really became the patron saint of lovers in the 19th century when all those Valentine's cards started to be printed, and giving cards and giving Valentine's gift became much, much more common. I think that St. Valentine would be shocked at this idea that he's, you know, wrapped up now in sort of nice, sweet little sort of pink love hearts and chocolate boxes. He was really representative of what the ancient Greeks called agape, which was their idea of selfless love. And that word agape was translated in Latin to the word caritas, which is where we get our word charity from. And I think it's something that we could all bring a bit more into our daily lives, partly because I think selfless love is on the decline. You know, there was a recent survey done at the University of Michigan which showed that empathy levels have been dropping in America rapidly, dropped by nearly 50% in the last 40 years, the steepest decline in the last 10 years. The evidence suggests we're caring less and less about other people.
But how do you measure empathy? I mean, I'm curious to know what the measures would have been.
Well, there's all sorts of different ways of measuring empathy. Sometimes it's done through surveys where people are asked, you know, to what extent do you help strangers or can you feel other people's feelings? A very famous empathy test is called reading the mind with the eyes, where you're shown a set of somebody's eyes, real eyes, and then you're asked to suggest what emotion they think that they're experiencing from the eyes that you're looking at. Is it anger or embarrassment or jealousy or happiness? And if you're very good at matching the word to the eyes, your empathy levels are high. You're good at reading other people's emotions. And in fact, most of us are really good at that. In fact, 98% of people have the ability to empathize and step into other people's shoes. So we've got a lot of potential. I just don't think we're always using it.
So then you actually kind of blow my doors off here by talking about the myth of romantic love. I mean, because we've gotten into this long section about all the different types of love there are. You just talked about agape, the selfless love, which doesn't appear to be in great supply at the moment. But the myth of romantic love?
Well, I think romantic love is a bit of a myth. It's a bit of a propaganda myth, actually. I mean, we all love falling in love. I have done so myself several times. There's nothing wrong with love. But the really interesting thing is that if you look over the last century, what we expect from a relationship has become more and more packed out. You know, if you go back to the 16th century, for example, in the Netherlands, that was when we started a new invention, which was the idea of marrying for love. This was a totally new idea. We never used to marry people with the idea that they would not just be someone who you'd have children with, but someone that you'd actually want to be with all the time. You'd want them to be your best friend. That was a new idea in the 16th to 17th century that spread. And then in the 18th century was the rise of what was called the Romantic movement, which spread from Germany and Britain across the United States. And this was the idea that love was all about all that head-over-heels swooning stuff. In fact, you know, lots of young people started committing suicide even for being out of love in the 18th century, and was partly spread through romantic novels and all that kind of thing. And we still find it today in Hollywood movies, and we're being sold this myth. Let me give you a little example. There's a film that came out a few years ago called Pride and Prejudice, based on a novel, an early 19th century English novel by Jane Austen. It was huge in the United States and in Europe, with Keira Knightley starring in it, this actress. But what was really interesting was that the producers of the film made two different versions, one for the U.S. market and one for the European market. In the European market, the film ends, as the book does, with the couple embracing and not really kissing, but just a sort of a gentle hug, as it were. But the U.S. version, they added on an extra 5 minutes at the end, which was a sort of big, slushy kiss at the end with romantic music which pulled your heartstrings, and it was totally fabricated to continue this mythology of romantic love, and this is what love has to be.
Interesting, and Americans have to have it. It has to be more mushy and romantic, and there has to be a
well, I don't know. That's what the focus groups seem to show, probably. But I'm sure there's a lot more variety there than the Hollywood producers think.
You know, I don't want to get stuck on spending the whole hour in love, but I have to ask about the concept of this term, capitalist love. What do you mean by that?
That's the idea that love is something that we buy and sell. And in fact, love that has been sold to us in the era of capitalist individualism of the 20th century. I think a great example of that is giving diamonds as a romantic gift. You know, it's incredibly common today. Go back 100 years, it wasn't. So the question is, what happened? Well, there is a very clear story, which is that in the 1930s, the World Diamond Cartel companies, the De Beers Cartel, hired a New York advertising agency called N.W. Ayer to run a campaign, probably one of the world's greatest, most successful advertising campaign, to make giving diamonds the ultimate gift of romantic love. They hired Hollywood actresses to wear diamonds. They invented slogans like Diamonds Are Forever, which is still around today. You know, Marilyn Monroe sung Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. And within its first few years of operation, diamond sales more than doubled. And it became incredibly common, even for quite poor people, to take out a loan to give their fiancé a gift of diamonds, and the fiancé expected it as well. So what I mean by capitalist love is the way that our culture of love has been shaped by the marketplace. And so, you know, giving these luxury gifts was invented for us, and we've inherited that from the past.
I did point out earlier, Roman Krznarek, that there are illustrations in the book, and in the section on love, there's a picture of a sculpture by Brancusi called The Kiss. And why is that in there?
Yeah, it's a sculpture of two figures in an embrace. They're quite kind of squarish or rectangular figures, and they're locked together in stone and looking eye to eye. In fact, their eyes sort of merge together. And I think this image is a representation of what we think about romantic lovers today, which is it's about finding this one other person, where this couple in this Brancusi sculpture are looking literally eye to eye and can see nobody else. But I think we can think about love in other ways. It isn't just two people staring at each other. It could be standing side by side and looking forwards, as it were, as a different kind of image. The kind of love where you find love in your deep friendships. What I found really interesting when talking to people about this book is that particularly a lot of older people really respond to this idea of, I don't want to find all my love in one relationship, often because they've been widowed. I want to find love in many different ways, through love of strangers, through love of my friends, children, and others, even a healthy kind of self-love, what the Greeks called philautia. And I think that makes sense to a lot of people, that in fact, a lot of us have more love in our lives than we previously imagined if you map out these different kinds of Greek love. And I think that staring eye to eye with one other person, although it's really important to us, isn't the whole story. It's not tapping into all the sources of love.
Puts a lot of pressure on that one person, certainly. If you're looking for the one is certainly going to have a lot of weight on his or her shoulders.
Yeah, that's a new idea. A couple of hundred years ago, we weren't looking for the one. You know, that idea really didn't exist. And that seems astonishing to people, but it's true.
All right, the second chapter in How Should We Live is on family. And can you relate to the character of J.G. Ballard that you bring up here?
Yes, that chapter starts with a story about an English writer, science fiction writer, in fact, called J.G. Ballard, whose wife died when their relationship was quite young. They had three young children. And he spent his life not only being a writer, but looking after bringing up his children himself. And I'm not quite in his situation because I do have a partner, and so she's around, but I do have young children. And what I really learned from looking at history and the history of family life was something that really surprised me, which was that the idea of a house husband, like J.G. Ballard was, is actually not a modern invention. We think of that super dad who can change diapers blindfolded as a modern idea, but in fact, go back to pre-industrial America in Europe, and many fathers were much more hands-on than they are today. And there's actually a good reason for it, was that work was much more based at the home. You might have been a craft worker, an agricultural laborer, cutting, you know, fields locally. And what it meant was that you were much more involved in childcare. You were making the crib and cutting the hay, even if you weren't always rocking the crib. And also, women often died in childbirth as well, so you had to pick up the pieces. So men used to be much more competent, and I find that inspiring.
There's a lot to be inspired by the wisdom of the ancients. That is the whole point of the book, How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. Roman Krznarek wrote it, and we'll come back and talk more with him and take your emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking once again with Roman Krznarek from the School of Life in London, a lifestyle philosopher, teacher of sociology and politics, and he joined us last June to talk about his book, How to Find Fulfilling Work. Work is one of the sections of his latest book, but there's a lot more to talk about here as well, about things we can learn from people who lived long ago. The book is called How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. In the absence of a phone screener, we can't take phone calls today, but we can take your emails. Those are more than welcome at jx@jeffnet.org. So as we talk more about family here, we often talk in the United States anyway about the decline of the family. What do you think, as you look at all the stuff you've crammed in here about family, is the key bit of wisdom we have lost over time?
It's a really interesting question about, you know, is family actually in decline? Well, one of the things people often talk about is, you know, the decline of the family meal, for example. You know, oh, we don't sit around and chat to each other now. We're all busy watching television. And if you just go back a few decades ago, families really sat down and talked to each other. Well, unfortunately, that is a little bit of a myth. You know, even go back to medieval Europe. Let's really throw our minds back. And families didn't used to sit down and talk to each other. In fact, people barely spoke at the table when they ate. Sometimes children and women ate separately from men. Even in the end of the 19th century in the United States, there wasn't a lot of chatter at the dinner table. Things, I think, started to go wrong with the invention of the radio when radios became common in the 1930s and 1940s. And, of course, television, I think, has destroyed the family meal in many ways. The typical family spending much more time in their car together than actually talking to each other. So in some ways, I think, you know, it's a bit of a myth to think that there is a decline of the family. But equally, I think we can learn from, you know, for example, as I was mentioning before, the way that, you know, house husbands used to be much more hands-on and more involved, and we can start taking some of those good ideas and applying them in our lives today, as I try to with my 5-year-old twins.
All right, so in other words, the guy shouldn't be sitting on the couch saying, hey, there's a game on here. I can't help you now.
Well, actually, if you look at even in families where both partners, both the man and the woman in a traditional household, are both working, the women are still doing much more the childcare and housework. And I think in an age of equality, well, it's pretty hard to get away with that. I think a lot of men do get away with it. But I think that, you know, if you do believe men and women are pretty equal, I think that there's a good chance that men should be picking up more of the childcare and housework. And I think the great myth is that this is taking you away from something that's great. I used to think that, oh, having children, this is going to take me away from being a writer. I can't have children. But actually, I've discovered that having children has expanded my life and my emotional range. I sometimes think of it like a piano. I used to play on one octave, and now I play on eight. You know, I feel sorrows more. You know, I cry more at films since I've had children, but also I feel joys more as well, and I'm thankful for it.
A full range of notes there for sure, all 88 keys on the piano. In nurturing relationships, we talked about love, we talked about family, we did talk a bit about empathy before, but I want to get further into this chapter on empathy in How Should We Live? And you mentioned this person, Giovanni Bernardone, and him kissing a leper. Why did he do that, and what's the name we know him by now?
Yes, that Giovanni Bernardone was, back in the year about 1206, he not only hugged a leper in Italy, in central Italy, but he went down to visit the Basilica of St. Peter's in Rome, and he was so disgusted by the opulence and the luxury of St. Peter's in Rome that when he walked out, he saw a beggar, and he swapped clothes with the beggar and spent the day begging for alms. And this man later formed a new brotherhood, and he was St. Francis of Assisi. And the idea of his brotherhood, of the Franciscans, was that you should live in poverty. You should live the life of the poorest people. That's how you have solidarity with people and what will inspire you to really care for them, something that, of course, Mahatma Gandhi, you know, did in the mid-20th century. And this is the idea of empathy. It's about stepping into somebody else's shoes, like in the extreme cases in Francis, swapping clothes with a leper, and trying to discover the lives of other people. And I think it's something we all need to practice in everyday life. I mean, how often do we walk past someone homeless, you know, along the street, asking for a few coins, and we don't look at them in the eye, we don't even say hello when they try and speak to us? I think we're all, you know, we have, you know, in reality, busy lives, but we often don't switch on our empathic brains.
There's a concept in here, homo empathicus. Whose theory was that, Roman?
Yeah, the concept of homo empathicus was actually invented by an American social thinker called Jeffrey Rifkin in a great book called The Empathic Civilization. And the idea there is that, look, for the last few hundred years, we've been sold this, I think, dangerous piece of propaganda, really, which is that human beings are essentially self-interested, individualistic creatures who care about nothing else than looking after number one. But the modern science of empathy is telling us that we are homo empathicus. We are built and wired for empathy and social cooperation. Neuroscientists have shown that we've got a 10-section empathy circuit in our brains. You damage part of it and you'll be unable to, for instance, you know, recognize fear on somebody else's face, or something like that. And we can all get better at empathizing, learn to do it as well. We can bring our wiring to life and bring our homo empathicus to the table.
You also relate the story in this section about C.P. Ellis, a former member of the Ku Klux Klan. This is an interesting story. What turned him around?
Yeah, C.P. Ellis was an almost forgotten figure in the U.S. civil rights movement, but a very important one and a great figure in the history of empathy. He was from Durham in North Carolina, from a poor, white, working-class background. He couldn't make ends meet, couldn't support his four kids and his wife, and so he started blaming his problems on African-Americans. And like his father before him, he joined the Ku Klux Klan and became a local leader, the exalted cyclops of the KKK in his area. And in 1971, his life changed when he was invited to a community meeting to tackle racial problems and tensions in local schools. He was invited because he was a very prominent figure. And he was elected to the head of this school committee, along with an African-American civil rights activist who he hated, called Anne Atwater. But as he worked with her, he discovered that they had a lot in common. He discovered, for example, that at the time he was working as a janitor at Duke University and she was a cleaner. They were both working as cleaners. They were both struggling to make ends meet. He went around trying to recruit members to his committee amongst the white folk who all slammed the door in his face because he was working with an African-American activist. And Anne Atwater got her door slammed in her face because she was working with a Klansman. And they discovered all these commonalities. And it basically blew away his prejudices, his working with her and conversations with her. And C.P. Ellis, at the end of this 10-day meeting, stood up in front of 1,000 people and tore up his Ku Klux Klan membership card. And he later became the leader of a union that was 70% African-American, the Janitors Union, and a great civil rights activist. And I think he is an inspiration for the power of conversation to expand empathy and change our lives.
And really putting yourself into somebody else's life situation and essentially walking a mile in their shoes, which brings up the story related in this chapter as well. George Orwell, what did he do in his spare time?
Yeah, George Orwell's normally thought about as a novelist, the writer of Animal Farm and 1984, these great books from the 1940s. But when he was a younger man, this very privileged Englishman from a very wealthy background decided to discover how the other half lived. And in the late 1920s, a bit like St. Francis of Assisi, he decided to become a tramp, a hobo, and live on the streets of East London. I mean, he went to Britain's most exclusive school, Eton, and then swapped his top hat and tie for an old trench coat with full of holes. And he spent weeks and sometimes months living on the streets with vagabonds and beggars and discovering really what it was like to be on the margins. And this totally blew his mind. He wrote about it in a great book called Down and Out in Paris and London. But what was really interesting was that, of course, it expanded his moral universe. He cared much more for homeless people and didn't walk straight past them. But it also nurtured his curiosity about strangers. It also really gave him great literary material for his books. It actually showed, I think, that empathy makes you good, but it's good for you too. And I'm a great advocate, actually, not just of doing empathy in practice, but even practicing it in your armchair by reading books like Down and Out in Paris and London, or watching films like The Color Purple or 12 Years a Slave, which I watched last night, films and books which get you to step into other people's shoes. And I've just founded something called the Empathy Library, a new website at www.empathylibrary.com, where you can find fantastic books and films all about empathy.
EmpathyLibrary.com. Okay, we'll keep making a note of that. Roman Krznarek, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is How Should We Live? And we have an email here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Coming back to our discussion about love and the idea of the one. And Wolfgang writes, just yesterday I thought how media is not an intermediary but a separator, an alienating device because it separates people from the real world. Ironically, at the same time, media sells everything by promising connectedness, lifestyle, love, fashion, belonging, beauty. All are types of homogenized relationship. So on one hand, alienation is disseminated, while on the other, the market is teased into buying by promising belonging. That again from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating thought. And I think it gets to the heart, in a way, of the ambiguities or complexities of digital culture. You know, here we are in a hyper-connected world. Through the media, through social networks, people are aspiring to have as many friends on Facebook as they can. But what's happening there? I think there's a lot of communication rather than conversation, connection rather than deep understanding. It's very difficult to tweet your deepest emotions in 140 characters. So I think on the one hand, you know, you've got this growing social connection. You know, 2.7 billion people are now on the internet. But we need to ask, what would the ancient Greeks have thought, for instance, about the quality of those connections and conversations? I mean, 10 billion text messages at least were sent around the world last year, probably 100 billion. I probably got the statistic wrong, but how many of those were really deep, empathic, nurturing, and adventurous conversations? So I think we need to learn to use media in smart ways. And if you think about what social media does to us, it often gets us to connect with people who are quite like us, not people who are different from us. And if you're interested in something like empathy, for instance, you know, one of the great empathic adventures is talking to strangers, getting in touch with people from different cultures and backgrounds, people different from you. That's what really shocks and surprises us. So I think we need to invent a new generation of apps which connect us with strangers.
Well, there is some of that, though. I mean, when you think about things like Uber and some of the other sites that allow car sharing, for example, instead of calling a cab, you're actually just sort of getting into somebody's car in San Francisco.
Yeah, and I think that kind of cooperative co-production use of the economy is a wonderful way of, in a way, challenging the alienation of modern life. You know, one in four people say that they're lonely. Well, it's not lonely if you share your car with somebody, and it's also economically a smart thing to do as well. And I think we're moving into a new era of social cooperation, really drawing out our empathic and cooperative selves. Car sharing is one way to do it. Local exchange trading schemes, I can't remember what they're called in the United States, where people use alternative currencies to bring communities together.
Sometimes it's time sharing, things like that, yeah.
Yeah, or, you know, farmers markets. All this stuff is about trying to, in a way, get back to a lot of community feeling that was being lost. Go back to medieval Italy, community was very strong. Today, communities are breaking down. Let's go back to the past, but not with nostalgia, of course.
Right. So and there's a whole section here on making a living. That's the whole second section of the book. And you do point out, as you did in your previous book, too, how to find fulfilling work, the end of this concept of a job for life. Certainly, we can see some parallels here with the Industrial Revolution. But, I mean, have there periodically been upheavals through history in how we view work and, I guess, more importantly, how work views us?
Well, certainly for most of history, work has been seen as a means to an end. And a necessary drudgery, not something that where we try and find fulfillment in life. But if you look at the Renaissance, I think there's good evidence that the ideal idea of work and being a person was much broader than our idea today of being a a specialist in a narrow field, which is what a lot of people aspire to. The idea of being a generalist, what I think was a wide achiever, was common back in the 16th century. That's what Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo were doing. Now, we're not all as talented as them. I'm certainly not, but certainly we can aspire to perhaps do several jobs at the same time and nurture the many sides of who we are, or at least to be a bit more experimental. You know, one of the figures I talk about in the book is Vincent van Gogh, the great painter who wasn't always a painter. You know, he started out as an elementary school teacher and an art dealer and even an evangelical preacher in the Belgian coal mines, and eventually he discovered painting. I think you're not going to discover your vocation unless you get a bit experimental like Vincent did.
When I consider the broad range of things you've covered here in How Should We Live, there's certainly a broader range out there. You really could kind of hit the tip of the iceberg here. How then, Roman, did you figure out how to limit the topics and choose so carefully from among people and time periods?
It was absolutely almost impossible. And the method I used was this. I looked at the kind of dilemmas that people have today, whether it's around love or death or work, and tried to find solutions to those dilemmas in history. So I, at the School of Life, the place that I teach in London, you know, I noticed how many people were unhappy in their romantic lives. And so I tried to think, okay, where is the great knowledge from history we can use? And I studied lots of things which were of no relevance whatsoever. You know, I studied divorce practices in Mongolia and in Ming Dynasty China, but I thought there was nothing much there of use to dealing with our love lives today. But there was stuff from the ancient Greeks, for instance. So it's a bit of cherry picking, and I could be accused of cherry picking the past, but why not pick the best cherries? You know, we're talking about our lives here. This stuff really matters.
It's a pretty tasty bowl. The book is called How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. Roman Krznarek wrote it, and he's been our guest once again. Roman, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on the program.
All right, take care. That'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. On tomorrow's Exchange at 8, we'll talk about declines in bee populations and what to do. Vents Day moves to Thursday this week only. We will have a call screener. We'll talk about teacher strikes and universal pre-K. And then we'll talk about tax help for low-income and elderly people in our 9 o'clock segment. All tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley for Charlotte Duren and all of us here. Thank you and have a great day.